Welcome to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast for June 2015. I'm your host, Don Cameron of Breskin Parr LLP in Toronto, Canada. We hope you'll find this podcast informative, but it should not be taken as legal advice. The opinions expressed are solely those of the participants. The Alice decision from the U.S. Supreme Court and the USPTO guidelines flowing from it have created what Bruce Sunstein describes as a thicket through which any successful patent applicant must pass. Bruce Sunstein is a founder and partner at Sunstein, Kahn, Murphy & Timbers LLP in Boston, Massachusetts. He's drafted patents in a variety of technological areas, including bioinformatics, electronic circuits and systems, computer hardware and software, communications and speech, medical devices, pharmaceuticals, and mechanical devices. Mr. Sunstein recently published an article in the New England Law Review entitled How Prometheus Has Upended Patent Eligibility, An Anatomy of Alice Corporation Proprietary Limited versus CLS Bank International. He's also recently presented a webinar on the topic of patent strategies for getting a software patent invention through the Alice thicket. I spoke with Mr. Sunstein from his office in Boston. Hello, Bruce.
Hi, Don.
Bruce, I have the advantage, a small advantage of being a Canadian in the sense that in watching the jurisprudence evolve from Bilski to Alice, many of us foreign observers think that the U.S. 101 test regarding software and business methods is in a bit of a mess, and the United States has painted itself into something of a corner with no way out. I wonder if I sense from your webinar presentation a great deal of frustration with the way things were, but at least perhaps a couple of directions as to how to wiggle your way around some of the current rules.
Well, first of all, I actually agree with that analysis. I think the test for what is patent eligible subject matter after Alice, and you can add to that list the Myriad decision as well as the Mayo versus Prometheus decision, they have created hopefully subjective criteria. And ultimately, I think the U.S. isn't going to solve its problems in this area until some legislation has been passed. But notwithstanding this state of affairs, I think we're not powerless to fight. And there are some things that can be done right now to help improve the odds of getting something through the system, at least over time.
And in your recent webinar, you referred to the Alice thicket in the PTO, and you said, and I'm just quoting from your presentation, the challenge has a big subjective element because the Alice decision reflects fuzzy thinking, and the PTO guidelines do nothing to remove the fuzz. How so?
Well, actually, there's so much fuzz in the decision that it's difficult to figure out how to identify the source of most of it. But one of the concepts that the Supreme Court articulates is that they're concerned about what they call preemption. How so, you might ask? They say that their concern is that if the claims are too much focused on broad concepts, then they go to what they call the fundamental building blocks of science and technology. And the concern is that claims directed to those fundamental building blocks will impede the advance of science and technology. And in terms of fuzz, that's some of the greatest fuzz I've ever read. Because it misunderstands how the patent system works. There's no patent that can impede the development of science and technology for a bunch of reasons. First of all, the contents of a patent are public, and people are free to read it and improve on it as they go forward. Second of all, what governs whether those claims are infringed? Typically, uses that are experimental and conducted in a private fashion are not likely to be noticed, let alone the source of litigation by the other side, And there's some authority that suggests that those experimental uses can't be reached to begin with. So this concept of preemption, which underpins all three of the decisions I just mentioned, in my opinion, is a large amount of baloney. The other thing that's interesting in terms of fuzz is the word preemption is mentioned in the PTO guidelines once, as far as I can recall, and it's not discussed at all, even though that concept underpins the decisions. So there are two court cases, at least two, one of which is California case involving Caltech against Hughes, where the preemption discussion was actually used in part as the basis for the decision. So the courts have figured some of this out. The Patent and Trademark Office, not at all. I could go on, but you'll need to get to the end of this podcast at some point, so let's move to the next question, Don.
Okay. In your presentation, you talk about the Alice Thicket having three steps to patentability, and let's deal with them one at a time rather than all three at once. The first part, which you describe as the easy part, is the question, is the claim to a process, machine, manufacture, or composition of matter? In Canada, I call those the traditional cubbyholes of patentability. Where does that question, likewise arise from Section 101?
Exactly. That's perfectly stated, Don. Section 101 lists those statutory categories, and if it's in one of those categories, it's eligible. And in fact, almost everything that's reasonably claimed in a patent application will fit into one of those cubbyholes. And the Supreme Court admits that its analysis of patent eligibility is premised on a series of exceptions that, at bottom, aren't in the law at all, but they are, as the court euphemistically says, are judicially created, meaning, in my opinion, there's no basis in the statute for these things, but we're going to do them anyway because we don't like what the statute's doing.
So the second question or second step in the Alice Thicket is really follows if the answer to the first question is yes, it fits within the traditional categories. The next question is the claim directed to a law of nature, a natural phenomenon, or an abstract idea, as you've described them, judicially recognized exceptions? I have trouble with the phrase directed to. Are they really asking, does the claim include an abstract idea?
Don, that's a beautiful question, and it's beautiful in part because the court doesn't really say what it means to be directed to an abstract idea or any of these other things. And there's no methodology for figuring out whether the claim is directed to one of these things. None of the decisions say how they figure out whether it's directed to one of these things. So, a claim, as I expect most of our listeners know, has a preamble, which will tell us generally the playing field we're on, a method of doing X comprising. And then it has a list of things usually that come after that colon that constitute the body of the claim. What is it in the body of the claim that triggers one of these judicially recognized exceptions? We don't really know.
So one of the ways you've suggested in figuring out what is an abstract idea, since the Supreme Court really hasn't given much guidance, is, and I'll break them up if you will. Number one is, what does the examiner say he or she thinks the abstract idea is?
Yes. We begin with the fact that since those three cases that I mentioned, we don't have any statement of what any of these things are. We only have the examples that come from court decisions. Now, ahead of Alice, we do have this Bilski case where they don't mention the word abstract idea, but they did say that The claim is directed to hedging, which, as recited by the court, is a fundamental economic practice. So we could use Bilski as a kind of a guide. It seems to me that every idea can't be an abstract idea, because claims really set forth ideas, don't they? I think a claim is, in some sense, an idea that captures some feature of technology. And if that were the case, then every claim could be invalidated, because they all include ideas. So there has to be something there, and we can at least start with Bilski and argue that not all ideas are abstract ideas.
And I guess one of the problems I have with Bilski is that, okay, if hedging is a fundamental economic practice and you can't get a patent on hedging, perhaps too because it's old and prior art and therefore is anticipated, if you abstract the claim enough to boil it down to what its idea is. But Bilski, and maybe you can correct me, may have been a particular way of carrying out hedging, a particular application of hedging. And in that extent, again, from my perspective, it isn't necessarily abstract when you figured out a particular application of an idea. And if it's an application of an idea, it isn't abstract anymore.
Don, I have to agree with you again. The court went out of its way to say, though, if you take some of these old concepts and just say that you're running them on a computer, they say that's not enough, you must need something more. There's so many things wrong with this formulation, it's upsetting and it's hard to begin, but still, that's the rationale for finding that an abstract idea is present. So we don't really know what an abstract idea is, and then when if it's found, though, as I've remarked, the court does allow you a chance to show that your claim does, when viewed as what the court calls an inventive concept, that's a direct quote, that the claim viewed as an inventive concept adds significantly more than the judicially created exception. We don't really know what significantly more means, but we're supposed to look at the claims, the claim limitations first, separately, then, quote, as an ordered combination. The court never even says what any of that is either. In other words, there's so much baloney going on in this decision that one is definitely floating in a sea of ambiguity. But nevertheless, that is the last step. So first, are we in one of the statutory classes? If so, is one of the judicially created exceptions to law of nature, abstract idea, natural phenomenon present? And third, if so, can it be shown that the inventive concept of the claim includes significantly more than the judicially created exception? That's the morass created by Alice.
It sounds harmonic to some of the case law from 20 or 30 years ago, where you couldn't necessarily get a patent on an algorithm, but if you had significant pre-algorithmic steps and post-algorithmic steps, then the whole thing would look more like an industrial process and therefore be more likely to become patentable. And
well,
perhaps
you,
that
yeah.
Perhaps that kind of addition is not exactly what's being thought here. It seems to be more of an application of the idea that generates the patentability in the 21st century, rather than just adding elements before or after the abstract idea.
Well, the case you're referring to in the U.S. that actually was a major departure was a decision in the 1980s, Diamond against Deere. And in that case, the court held that a method involving filling up rubber molds with liquid pre-vulcanized rubber, before it's been treated, and then solving something called the Arrhenius equation to figure out how much time remained before the rubber would be cured, repeatedly solving that equation, and then when the time is shown as zero, spitting out, opening up the mold, spitting out the molded rubber, that was held to be eligible to be patented by a mere 5-4 vote of the Supreme Court, but that's enough to do it. That was held to be eligible subject matter, and they had to distinguish a whole bunch of cases that are quite similar, for one reason or another, saying, but this time it's a process for molding rubber. And the court does say in the Alice decision that Diamond against Deere remains good law, even though they also said all these other cases, such as Gottschalk versus Benson, which was a method of converting, I believe, binary-coded decimal to decimal, that was still good law as well. Everybody else thought that Gottschalk versus Benson had been overruled by Diamond against Deere. So there are a lot of contradictory cases held by the court to be all part of the seamless web of its wisdom. So I think, in fact, I've written a law review article on the Alice decision, and I've shown in that article that you can analyze Diamond against Deere according to the Alice principles, and you'd have no problem invalidating on the basis of ineligibility the claims that were involved in that case. So the reason is that the Alice test is, as I say, hopelessly subjective. But still, that's the current environment.
And when we post this podcast, I'll include a link to your law review article. In your webinar, you offer some suggestions as to what we have to do nowadays to get around some of the objections that are raised by the patent office, or tips on avoiding them perhaps altogether by drafting and phrasing the invention in a certain manner. One of the suggestions you make is to look for physical and technological features of the invention. What are you talking about there?
Well, a technological feature, in my view, is something where the computer environment is used to achieve a result that has some kind of beneficial physical effect. For a client not too long ago, I got a series of patents for software systems. It was completely software-based systems. But when they ran on a network-attached storage hardware device, then the hardware could make accesses to the hard disk approximately an order of magnitude faster. That's a great story, actually. But in this case, even though your claims are directed to software, and even though you might find all these reasons why it's an abstract idea, although goodness knows what it is there, still, you have this physical result that is unexpected, and also it's novel, certainly. And when you have the physical result, I think the presence of a result that's physical makes it much harder for the court to say it's abstract, right? If you have a physical result of something, you know, if the software controlled a hammer and it hammered a nail, is that an abstract idea? Probably not. So I think that kind of thing can make a difference.
Yeah, it sounds a little like the concrete and tangible results from, again, 10 or 20 years ago.
Indeed. And in Europe, you know, we have the rule in the European Patent Convention that says computer software is not patentable, quote, as such. Then you ask a European, well, what do you mean, as such? And they'll say, well, if you can show a technical effect, then it's... You can get claims that allowed that are directed to that technical effect, and then that's not the computer software the computer program as such. So I think if one goes in that particular direction, the court has trouble attacking it because there's too much science involved, and they can't say this is like hedging or this is like some other kind of old economic practice.
One of the suggestions you make is to include some of these physical or technological features in the preamble of the claim. Could you explain the advantage you see there?
Well, the benefit of doing this, first of all, for any examiner who reads the entire claim, it shouldn't make any difference. But regrettably, I get plenty of rejections under Section 101 for software cases that I'm prosecuting, where it's completely evident that the examiner doesn't care what's in the body of the claim. But they do have to recite what the abstract idea is, and if my preamble is lengthy, and it says, for example, a method of a software system for use in, for example, a computer hardware environment involving network-attached storage that produces faster disk accesses, comma, the method comprising. Even if the examiner is thinking that there's an abstract idea, I can at least point the examiner's nose at my preamble saying, how can you say you have an abstract idea when this is what the technology is directed to? Mm-hmm. So I think it gives the applicant, it gives counsel for the inventor an additional leg to stand on in arguing the eligibility of the software with the examiner who, as I say, doesn't necessarily read the rest of the claim.
When I initially heard that suggestion, I asked myself, is there any fear of narrowing the claim too much by doing that? But having said that, if that's the invention recited in the body of the claim, it's really a circular submission. You're really saying the same thing twice, in effect, and you're not narrowing the invention.
That's right. I don't think it narrows. You are saying the same thing twice. One of the things that I think still is an advantage is you don't want to give away how you do it. So in the preamble of this case that I've talked about, speeding up the disk accesses, I haven't said how I've achieved that result.
Mm-hmm.
That can be in the body. But I at least want to show that there's something. You're right. What's that old phrase? It was in the State Street Bank decision about concrete
and
tangible.
Yeah, concrete and tangible result, I think.
Something like that. So, but you want to show in the preamble how you're getting there and what, not how you're getting there, but what you're getting to and what you're achieving, because I think that does help remove the claim from the realm of the abstract.
Does including the source code in the application help at all?
Well, sometimes there are questions about, is my disclosure sufficient? We're not talking about Section 101 here. We're talking about just having a patent application that tells enough to this hypothetical person of ordinary skill in the field how to implement the technology. And certainly if you give your source code there, that can be helpful. There have been plenty of patents with really abundant description of how the technology is implemented, maybe not with exactly the source code, but with logical flow diagrams galore. I believe there's a case involving Accenture not too long ago where it was held ineligible, and there was all kinds of magnificent disclosure. So I don't think it's going to help in the 101 domain, but I think it's always important to make sure you provide enough information so that this hypothetical person can implement. On the other hand, in virtually all the cases I've filed in the past 20 years, I think a combination of diagrams that include system architecture, logical flow diagrams, as well as the user interface that includes screenshots or replicas of screenshots, those things provide enough detail so that an ordinarily skilled software architect could make it happen. So I don't think you need to add the source code.
In your webinar, you suggested the use of a declaration to refute the examiner's position. What advantage is there in filing a declaration?
Well, we're now into a bit of a controversial area because nobody has expressed any rules as to how to evaluate rejections under Section 101. But the basic concept, if you think about it, is this. Unless the Patent Office has a basis for rejecting my application, they need to allow it. So I think the burden is always on the office to have a basis for the rejection. If I submit, after getting a rejection, a declaration, which is actually evidence, right? I've put evidence in the record, and if that evidence shows that the things that the Patent Office is saying are unsupported and, in fact, are contradicted by facts that I'm putting in the declaration, then I would argue I've rebutted the grounds advanced by the Patent Office for finding patent ineligibility. So I think the advantage of this is that I have an evidentiary basis for saying that if the Patent and Trademark Office maintains the ineligibility rejection for the same reasons, and if I can show furthermore that I've rebutted those reasons, maybe I have a basis on appeal for winning that has to do with the burden on the Patent Office and the fact that they haven't carried their burden.
Another suggestion that, if I understand it correctly, is that you can point out some prior art that performs the abstract idea in other ways so that your client's invention is not preempting that particular abstract idea in the way it carries out the abstract idea.
Exactly. And now, first of all, in other words, we go to the fundamental basis for the Alice decision, namely this theory about preemption. And if we can show that there's six other ways of doing the thing, the sort of thing that I've claimed, six ways that are different to achieve the same end, and I'm patenting only one of them, how can they be concerned about preemption? I think that's a good argument, and as I mentioned, Caltech versus Hughes is a decision in the Central District of California last November that supports this kind of rationale. The difficulty with this argument is the Patent and Trademark Office doesn't accept it. At least they haven't said a thing about it. Nevertheless, at some point, in some form, maybe it's going to be a patent trial and appeal board decision, or maybe it'll be a Federal Circuit decision, I think that the Patent Office does not have carte blanche to reject whenever it feels like, and having an argument of this kind in the record will advance the cause of the eligibility of this invention to be patented.
Now, at the beginning of our discussion today, you mentioned that pending any change in the legislation, we're going to have to live with Alice, Prometheus, and Myriad. Is there really any hope of Congress overruling Alice, Prometheus, and or Myriad?
Well, it's certain that if we just wait for Congress to do it on its own, nothing will happen. But one of the things I've found is that a growing number of people, including people who prosecute patents in the U.S., and including people who care about getting patents because they are users of the patent system, an increasing number of these people are thinking that legislation to change this picture is a good idea. With concerted action by that kind of constituency, I think Congress being the kind of political animals that Congress is, this could happen. It will certainly take a lot of work. But I think it's possible, and in fact, I'm on a committee of the AIPLA, the American Intellectual Property Law Association, that's looking into precisely such a thing. And in that respect, the AIPLA is not acting alone. If these groups work together, maybe something interesting will be happening over the next few months.
Any thoughts on what kind of amendment would help?
When it comes to food, I'll do almost anything for a meal as long as it's well prepared. Maybe the legislation is something like that as well. There are a lot of different ways it could be done. My law review article has one proposal that didn't have the benefit of my working for the AIPLA on that committee, and that does have one proposal. But there are a number of ways it could be handled. I might mention that a problem like this happened years ago, and I mentioned this in the law review article as well. Our current Section 103 that handles obviousness in the United States was actually drafted into what became the 1952 Patent Act to overrule a case called Cuno Engineering, in which the Supreme Court talked about invention as involving, quote, a creative flash of genius. Don't you love that? So when is there a creative flash of genius, and when is there not? That will decide whether the invention is eligible, whether the invention is a patentable advance over the prior art. Well, Section 103 has this new idea of non-obviousness. It's pretty short section, by and large, and maybe we can come up with something that's equivalently short that would remake the Supreme Court in terms of its analysis of what constitutes eligible subject matter. So that's the hope. I think it can be done. As I say, one proposal's in my article, but any good proposal would be a welcome one.
Thank you very much for these insights, Bruce.
Don, thank you very much. It's a real pleasure talking with you.
Bruce Sunstein is a founder and partner at Sunstein, Kahn, Murphy & Timbers, LLP in Boston, Massachusetts. For further information on Mr. Sunstein's article entitled How Prometheus Has Upended Patent Eligibility, An Anatomy of Alice Corporation Proprietary Limited versus CLS Bank International, for information on his webinar on patent strategies for getting a software patent invention through the Alice Thicket, and for information on our other jurisdiction podcasts, please visit iplawpodcast.com. You've been listening to Jurisdiction, the International Intellectual Property Law Podcast. I'm Don Cameron of Breskin & Parr, LLP in Toronto, Canada. Thank you for listening.